fear that they're going to be, you know, attacked by gangs or drug trafficking.
Adriana, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Adriana Beltran, Executive Director of the Seattle International Foundation, and Laura Gottesdiener, correspondent in Reuters Mexico and Central America Bureau. We will link to Laura's article, How a Drug Trafficking Mayor in Honduras Fueled the U.S. Migration Crisis. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Berkdine, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terra Sena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Friday, September 24th, 12:05 p.m., Movin' On will feature the music of Dave Carter and Tracy Grammer. They were national stars based here in Portland. They had recorded several albums before Dave's tragic death in 2002. Since then, Tracy has been promoting Dave's songs on her own album. We will also be hearing some rare selections by Tracy and friends recorded at Winter Folk 15 in 2012, a benefit for Sisters of the Road Cafe. Also, we're going to be hearing several selections from John McCutcheon's latest album. Tune in Friday, September 24th, a little after 12 noon, for a celebration of the music of Dave Carter and Tracy Grammer.
I see the mountain, and that is all I see.
It's the Fall KABU Drive, and our theme is the sounds of democracy. Everything you hear on KABU is, in its own way, the sound of democracy, because we are a community radio station. Community is one of the most democratic types of media. We're non-commercial and independent. We're supported by our members so that we can keep the airwaves democratic and continue to bring you the valuable voices of your community. Democracy is an experiment, and so is community radio. We're featuring content focused on democracy itself and democratic ideas across the schedule this drive. You can support KABU by donating right now. Go to kboo.fm/give or on your mobile phone, text KBOO to 44321 or click donate in the KBOO mobile app. Thank you for supporting your community radio station.
KABU Community Radio is hiring a finance coordinator. Our finance coordinator is responsible for accounting for and providing reports on KABU's finances, ensuring that the financial systems function effectively, efficiently, and in a timely manner, and supporting human resource procedures and policies. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kabu.fm/employment. Applications are due by October 4th. KABU is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on this Fall Fun Drive edition of the KABU Evening News, Clackamas County Commissioner Mark Scholl faces condemnation for anti-Semitic remarks, redistricting hits another snag in the Oregon legislature, and Texas further restricts reproductive rights by banning abortion pills. We'll be right back. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, September 22nd, 2021. KABU is currently in our fall fun drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kabu.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. Clackamas County Commissioner Mark Scholl has been condemned again by his fellow commissioners and constituents for sharing a meme that likened coronavirus restrictions to the Holocaust. The Facebook post has since been taken down. It appeared to compare the restrictions faced by Jewish people in Nazi Germany to COVID restrictions like mask and vaccine mandates, reading, quote, "Anyone see the parallel?" Scholl's post was condemned by his fellow commissioners in a statement. This is not the first time Scholl has made inflammatory comments about coronavirus restrictions or marginalized groups. In June, he compared vaccine passports to Jim Crow laws, the laws that legalized racial segregation. The other commissioners on the Clackamas County Board voted to restrict Scholl's ability to serve as a liaison between groups in the board as a result of that. He's also said transphobic, xenophobic, and Islamophobic things, as well as derogatory comments about the Black Lives Matter movement. Scholl has been censured by the board and faced widespread calls to resign ever since. A Recall Mark Scholl campaign was started in January, and the campaign leaders say they are still collecting pledges to sign a petition to recall the commissioner. The redistricting process in the Oregon legislature has hit another potential roadblock. This is after Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek went back on a deal giving Republicans an equal say in redistricting in exchange for a Republican promise to not walk out. The new issue that may derail the proceedings is COVID. A notice came out yesterday afternoon that someone who'd been in the Capitol on Monday had tested positive for the coronavirus. Kotek's office announced that lawmakers won't be expected back in the Capitol until Saturday, and that COVID tests will be available in Salem tomorrow for lawmakers and staff, with results available by Friday afternoon. Yesterday, Kotek split the redistricting committee into two, one responsible for mapping the six congressional districts and the other drawing the boundaries for the state's 90 legislative districts. New maps must be passed by Monday the 27th, or the legislature will no longer be in control of the process. If just three Republicans walk out of the special session, there won't be quorum and nothing can get done. If the Monday deadline passes, the redrawing of political boundaries will be done by the Secretary of State. About half of state workers subjected to the governor's vaccine mandate will have until the end of November to get their shots. Around 24,000 workers represented by the union Service Employees International Union 503 bargained for an extension of the vaccine mandate. It's not yet known whether the extension will apply to the nearly 18,000 other workers under the mandate. The union didn't secure any exceptions to the mandate that weren't there before, but they did push the required date back to November 30th and secured extra time off for union members who would need to recover from vaccine side effects. The October 18th deadline will still apply to teachers and healthcare workers. If workers don't get vaccinated by their deadline, they could be fired. Open enrollment periods for making changes to healthcare coverage are coming up. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story in Washington.
Washingtonians will soon have a chance to change their health coverage, and a few tips can help folks pick the best plan for themselves or their family. About 240,000 Washingtonians who aren't covered through their employer get insurance through the State Health Exchange, where financial help is available to pay premiums. The open enrollment for the exchange is November 1st through December 15th. Dr. Rhonda Randall with United Healthcare says people should keep next year's plans in mind when choosing their coverage.
Anticipate what your expenses are for next year. So are you anticipating you're going to need to have a certain procedure, or you've recently been diagnosed with a specific condition, or maybe you're planning to expand your family?
The Medicare open enrollment period is October 15th through December 7th. Randall says people on Medicare need to consider a separate prescription drug or Part D program and a Medicare Advantage or supplement plan for additional benefits, such as prescription drugs, vision, and dental coverage. Nationwide, about 180 million Americans get their insurance through an employer-sponsored plan. Randall says employers typically set aside 2 to 3 weeks for open enrollment at the end of the year. She says people should think about mental health coverage as well.
We have seen an increase interest in mental health needs lately. So that's another important thing to check on. Does your employer have an employee assistance program, and does the medical plan benefits that they're offering have the mental health coverage that you're looking for?
Randall also notes virtual care is becoming a greater priority for some people.
Those visits are designed really to be for specific conditions, convenience care, sometimes the maintenance of chronic conditions, and often are more affordable as well.
She advises people to look into the wellness programs that health plans offer and any specialty benefits. She adds it's important to understand the terminology, premium, deductible, copay, and others, and says United Healthcare offers a guide to these terms on its website. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Portland police violated state law by live streaming protesters, according to a decision this week by a Multnomah County judge. KBOO's Josh Salem has the story.
The Portland Police Bureau violated state law and a contract with the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon by live streaming videos of protests last summer. That's according to a ruling from Multnomah City Judge Thomas Ryan that says that a protester suing the city over the live stream suffered, quote, real and probable injury, end quote. Police are not allowed to collect information about the political, religious, or social views or activities of an individual or group, unless the information is directly related to a crime or criminal investigation. In July of 2020, the ACLU of Oregon filed a lawsuit challenging police live streaming. A temporary restraining order was granted, barring Portland from collecting or maintaining video footage of protesters in public spaces outside of a criminal inquiry. A much older 1988 agreement with the ACLU also prohibited the Portland Police Bureau from taking photographs of protesters at demonstrations. This ruling states even internal use of live stream protest videos by police still violates the law and the city's agreement with the ACLU. The judge did put an immediate hold on the ruling, expecting an appeal by the city. Deputy City Attorney Ryan Bailey told the court police rely heavily on live stream demonstration video to direct officers' actions. The police previously stated they share live stream video footage to improve public transparency and to deter criminal conduct. Protester number one, the plaintiff in court, said she was a parent attending the demonstrations because she was sickened and devastated by police violence against protesters. She never consented to police capturing video or audio at the protest. After the ruling, she said that standing up to injustice was important to her, adding, quote, I am grateful the court saw how harmful this practice is and chose to put a permanent stop to it, end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Portland City Commissioner Mingus Maps wants to install an artificial intelligence system to answer around 20% of the non-emergency calls currently handled by dispatchers at the Bureau of Emergency Communications. This year's record-high homicides and shootings in Portland, combined with staffing vacancies, has caused the Bureau to struggle in quickly handling both emergency and non-emergency calls. Some 911 callers in Portland are put on hold for minutes, while the national average is 15 to 20 seconds. The software costs $70,000 to install, and MAPS will seek other commissioners' approval for funding during the fall budgeting process. Emergency communications spokesperson Dan Duthit says the Bureau is, quote, still ironing out the details of the software, and so it is unclear how the program will work. With 114 current dispatchers, the agency is in the process of training 9 new operators with more hiring in the future, but the training time for operators is 18 months. The UN Security General has called for an international ban on drones. With that story and others, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Today, autonomous weapons can choose targets and kill people without human interference. They should be banned.
United Nations Secretary Antonio Guterres called on the U.S. and other nations to stop pursuing the development of drones and other weaponry based on artificial intelligence. He made the remarks Tuesday, moments before a series of speeches by world leaders at the annual UN General Assembly in New York City. At the assembly, President Joe Biden spoke about his efforts to rebuild alliances and described the recent U.S. military exit from Afghanistan as not a retreat from the world stage, but a shift to a new chapter.
We're opening a new era of relentless diplomacy, of using the power of our development aid to invest in new ways of lifting people up around the world.
A new book claims two emails detailing Hunter Biden's involvement and potential misconduct with foreign business leaders in the Ukraine and China are genuine. They were among materials reportedly taken from his laptop last year, according to evidence presented in the book The Bidens by Politico reporter Ben Schreckinger. Vice President Kamala Harris on Tuesday condemned the treatment of Haitian migrants at the southern border after images circulated appearing to show Border Patrol agents on horseback grabbing individuals seeking to enter the U.S.
What I saw depicted about those individuals on horseback treating human beings the way they were is horrible. And I fully support what is happening right now, which is a thorough investigation into exactly what is going on there.
Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts on Tuesday introduced a bill that would reinstate a federal eviction moratorium as the Delta variant of the coronavirus fuels outbreaks nationwide.
If Congress can step up now and pass legislation that keeps families in their homes through the duration of this emergency.
House Democrats late Tuesday passed a bill to keep the federal government funded through early December, but it faces uncertain prospects in the Senate. Congress must act within a matter of days to avoid a government shutdown when current funding expires at the end of this month. Facebook allegedly overpaid the Federal Trade Commission to spare CEO Mark Zuckerberg from individual legal action related to the Cambridge Analytica data leak probe. In the lawsuits made public Tuesday, shareholders claimed that members of Facebook's board allowed the company to overpay on its fine in order to protect Zuckerberg. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to a special Fall Fun Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member or renew your KBOO membership at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. Tonight they'll cover birth justice and Black maternal health. At 6, it's The Underground, then at 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with a low of 59 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 76. Today in history, in 2015, American baseball player Yogi Berra passed away at the age of 90. Berra is widely regarded as one of the greatest baseball catchers of all time and was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1972. The quote of the day is from Berra, who said, quote, "I tell the kids, somebody's got to win, somebody's got to lose. Just don't fight about it. Just try to get better." Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed a new piece of legislation that will further restrict abortion health care access in the state. The new law prevents providers from prescribing abortion-inducing drugs more than 7 weeks into pregnancy. The previous limit was 10 weeks. Those who, quote, intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly violate the law, including out-of-state sources, by providing medication through the mail, will now face criminal penalties, as much as $10,000 in fines and 2 years in prison. The law could be difficult to enforce, since it would also apply to international organizations providing abortion medication through the mail. Soon after, Texas passed a bill on September 2nd banning all abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, there was a sharp increase in visits to online sites that provide abortion drugs in the mail. Mark Jones is a professor of political science at Rice University. Jones said that while about a third of Texans want to see abortion ended entirely, except when pregnancy threatens the life of the pregnant person, about half of Texans want abortion to remain legal. Six Ojibwe tribes are suing Wisconsin over a fall wolf hunt, and tribes urge the federal government to overhaul mining regulations. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Six Ojibwe tribes in Wisconsin are suing the state in federal court to stop the fall wolf hunt, saying their treaty rights are being violated. Danielle Kading has more.
The Lac des Flambeaux, Red Cliff, and Bad River tribes are among those suing Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Secretary Preston Cole and the Natural Resources Board. They say state officials have failed to put safeguards in place to protect tribe share of the wolf harvest quota that they're entitled to under federal treaties. In February, hunters blew past their quota, killing 218 wolves. Lac des Flambeaux Tribal President John Johnson Sr. says tribes intend to fight to uphold their treaty rights.
And I would like to see the state working with the tribes, you know, allowing us to take our fair share.
Tribes aim to protect the animal from harvest because they view the wolf as a brother, but they claim the Natural Resources Board is trying to cancel out their share with the quota it set for this fall. The board's chair, Fred Prain, says the board is following the law.
And we believe we've done that. And if the judge rules differently, then we'll have to, you know, digest the response from the judge and then meet and deliberate as a board.
The Wisconsin DNR says it's reviewing the lawsuit. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
A coalition of tribes and environmental groups is urging the federal government to overhaul how it regulates mining in the western U.S. and Alaska. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, they say current rules disproportionately impact indigenous people and harm the environment.
The Havasupai tribe from Arizona and the Fort Belknap Indian community in Montana, along with other groups, filed a rulemaking petition with the U.S. Interior Department last week. They're urging the agency to tighten and modernize federal oversight of hard rock mining on public lands. Prospecting in the U.S. is still largely guided by the General Mining Law of 1872, signed by President Ulysses S. Grant. The tribes say the law is long outdated and to blame for polluting sacred sites, water sources, and animal habitat for generations, and fails to hold polluters accountable. They're calling on the Bureau of Land Management to further protect tribal and cultural resources along with the environment and close loopholes they say allow the mining industry to avoid public review and tribal consultation. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, hard rock mining has contaminated more than 40% of watersheds in the West. Leaders of the Havasupai tribe say uranium extraction near the Grand Canyon could contaminate their sole water source. The Navajo Nation is still grappling with the effects of more than 500 abandoned uranium mines left over from the Cold War. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland last week signed a water compact for a Northwest Montana tribe that's been in the works for decades. Aaron Bolton has more on the largest water rights settlement in U.S. history.
The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes relinquished thousands of water rights claims off the Flathead Indian Reservation in exchange for nearly $2 billion that will repair a large irrigation system on the reservation. The landmark deal has also returned the National Bison Range on the reservation to the tribes. The range remains open to the public, and the transition to tribal management has already been taking place. The Water Compact was first approved by state lawmakers in 2015 and was passed in Congress last year. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
An email to tribal leaders from the National Congress of American Indians announces the 2021 White House Tribal Nations Summit, which takes place virtually in November. Tribal leaders and government officials will address Indian country issues, policy initiatives, and goals. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
This week, South Dakota's governor asked the state education department to delay the process of updating social studies standards for public schools. The move comes amid outcry over certain elements, including the removal of Native American references. Tribal groups say they'll keep applying pressure during the pause. Mike Mullen has the story.
While South Dakota hits the reset button on updating social studies standards for schools, tribal groups opposed to the plan say they'll keep pushing for inclusion. This week, Governor Kristi Noem asked the state's Department of Education to delay implementing the standards for up to 1 year. The latest version of the plan has seen public backlash over removing several references to Ocheté Chacoan history and culture. Sarah White of the South Dakota Education Equity Coalition says a long pause isn't exactly a sigh of relief. She feels it allows the state to kick the can down the road rather than address a lack of Native American teachings.
This was another clear evasion of responsibility for Indigenous students, for inclusion, for anything of that nature.
White says it falls in line with NOAM's past actions, including shifting the Office of Indian Education to the Department of Tribal Relations. The coalition will pursue legislation to move those duties back to the Education Department and press for a fair process for developing curriculum. The proposal also was criticized by far-right groups who argued conservative voices were silenced. White says what's happening in South Dakota is part of a broader and long-standing failure to tell a more robust story of Native American history in classrooms.
We haven't, as a nation, admitted or even faced the truth of what happened with Indigenous people.
In neighboring Montana, state officials face a lawsuit over claims the curriculum there about Native American history fails to meet constitutional requirements. In South Dakota, NOAM's order for a delay didn't exactly specify what prompted the action, but said more public input is needed. The plan, released in August, differed from a draft proposal put together by a working group earlier in the summer. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
A new report says many U.S. telephone companies have yet to install mandated technology that will block the ubiquitous, unwanted marketing messages known as robocalls. But the phone companies and the marketers both face a deadline and shutdowns if they don't comply. Mark Richardson has more.
They are irritating, they're unwanted, and now robocalls are illegal. Consumer watchdog groups hope a looming deadline will finally force U.S. phone companies to take stopping robocalls seriously. A new report from the Arizona Public Interest Research Group Education Fund finds only one-third of the largest mobile and home phone service providers nationwide have installed the technology available to block unwanted marketing calls, which can arrive dozens of times a day. Arizona PERG Executive Director Diane Brown says the calls are not only frustrating, but can also be costly.
In addition to being annoying, illegal robocalls cost Americans $3 billion annually in wasted time and another $10 billion annually in fraud.
Brown says starting in June, all U.S.-based phone companies were required to install software that blocks so-called spoof calls when the caller ID doesn't identify the actual caller. The report says many phone service providers are dragging their feet. But Brown says another deadline is on the calendar this month, and it's aimed squarely at forcing the telemarketers perpetrating the scams to clean up their act.
On September 28th, phone providers are required to block calls from companies that haven't at least reported their status to the Federal Communications Commission.
Of the 3,000 telecommunications providers regulated by the FCC, the study found only 17% have completely implemented anti-robocall technology, 27% have partially applied it, and 56% says they're developing proprietary software to block illegal calls. Brown says if you're still receiving them, you can report calls directly to the FCC.
If a consumer receives a robocall, they can register their phone number and also issue a report at www.donotcall.gov.
The full report is online at arizonapergedfund.org. I'm Mark Richardson for Arizona News Connection.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is seeing disturbing patterns.
Oregon Congressman Kurt Schrader, who inherited a bunch of money from his grandfather, a Pfizer exec, voted against letting Medicare negotiate drug prices. The corruption is corrosive. In Newburgh, Oregon, where the school board banned signs, shirts, etc. for Black Lives Matter and LGBTQ rights, a school staffer showed up in blackface to protest vaccine mandates. In Rowlett, Texas, a couple had to leave a bar because they wouldn't take their masks off, masks they wore because their infant has immune deficiency. While in Del Rio, Texas, thousands of Haitian refugees fleeing that country long beset by man-made and natural disasters are being sent back with our tax dollars. The intolerance is intolerable. Have we all been brainwashed by the billionaires' media, made nervous and susceptible by the billionaire-controlled government saying they can't afford what we need to eke by? Them, not us. Trips into space, but not enough money to get to work. The injustice cannot be justified. This is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to a special Fall Fun Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 22nd, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, so we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Nadia Ramlagan, Mike Moen, Mark Richardson, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is in our fall fund drive, which means that now is a great time to become a member and support your local community radio station. If you'd like to contribute to KBOO, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Your support is very much appreciated. Stay tuned now for Making Contact, covering birth justice and Black maternal health.
This week on Making Contact, the magic of childbirth. Through the work and birth stories of midwife Allegra Hill, the producers of Rework Radio explain how Black midwives in Los Angeles are helping women to experience empowered births.
From the UCLA Labor Center, we bring you Rework. I'm Saba Wahid.
And I'm Veena Humpapour.
Each birth is a miracle, and I am fortunate to get to experience that miracle so many times. Birth continues to affect my life in the most wonderful way because it helps me stay in gratitude and stay present and experience the magic that is the introduction of a new person on the planet.
There's such a veiling around birth and labor, and how much people know or understand. There's almost like a mystery around it.
I feel like there's so much we miss in terms of the work women do. Emotional labor, having a child. It's literally called labor, right? Like, women are putting a lot into carrying and having and caring for a baby. These are things that are so invisible in the world. One thing that's really beautiful in this story is the ties between women and the ties between generations. In Allegra's story, we focus on the generations within her family. We don't spend enough time focusing on these really special bonds between women. Allegra was born in Culver City in Los Angeles, and her mom gave birth to her in the same birth center where her older sister Christina was born. Growing up, Allegra's ideas of labor and birth and delivery were really different from what we see in television and in the movies.
She said that she had me in the same room, in the same position as she did as my sister, standing up. When my head was born, my hand was up. I was crying. And my mom, she said that she just asked me why I was crying, and she said, "Where did you come from and where are you going?" My dad, he always talks about like rubbing in the vernix, which is like the coating that's on a baby when it's born. I just think that they were like in the zone. They're like all blissed out and in the zone. I have like pictures from when I was probably less than an hour old, and my mom just looked so happy. She'd had a really wonderful experience in birth, and so when I was growing up, that's what I thought was normal, and I didn't really realize until maybe college that my peers' moms were not having those kinds of experiences in birth. And I think that it has a huge impact on how I live my life and the work that I do, and also the way that I birth my own children.
I was really surprised to hear how early Allegra's memories are. Most of us don't remember anything before three, if that.
I actually have memories of like being a baby, the feeling of being carried around before I was able to walk. My parents had a house in Mar Vista on Stewart Street, and I have memories from being there. We had like chickens in the backyard and we had a pigeon coop. There were three people that raised me, my mom and my dad and my paternal grandmother, Mamo.
Allegra's other set of grandparents also lived in Los Angeles. One night they fell asleep and they had been smoking and the whole house ended up catching on fire.
They had brain damage from the smoke from the fire. When that happened, they were going to need a lot more care than they needed before. My family moved into the house in Baldwin Hills with my grandmother.
There were a lot of changes in Allegra's life as a kid, and they just continued to add on.
During that time, my parents got divorced. So I actually have like a period of my childhood where I don't have memories. I think I just like blocked it out because it was too hard. Play Mountain Place that like really helped support me. It's really feelings focused. So if you're having a feeling, you like learn to have it and process through it instead of using other coping techniques. They teach that kids really process through play. And so instead of like sitting in a class, I was climbing trees and digging and using my imagination and really playing. I was probably like a little bit of a mess, but they were like, that's okay. She'll just like play it out or she'll just cry it out.
So Allegra describes Play Mountain Plays as a school for hippies. It was really big on processing emotions and play, and students had unique relationships with their teachers and their families.
One of the teachers there, that was the first person that I knew who was going to have a baby at home. I was friends with some of the kids from that family. If I went to their house, they'd be like, oh, that's where Cedar was born. And it was just like very normal, like a thing that happened in their house. The teacher brought the baby with her to school. Part of my time at the school was just being with her baby, holding him a lot and getting him to sleep and figuring out what he likes. And so that felt like part of my curriculum. That was when I got really into babies, when I was a kid at that school.
The school had become such a place of safety and support for Allegra that it was actually quite hard for her to think about moving on from it.
I pretty much stayed until I got my period, and then I was like, oh my God, I have got to get out of this school. It is for kids. And so I actually left halfway through seventh grade, and I went into Smash in Santa Monica and then SAMO High. I know a lot of kids like didn't like high school, but I liked it. I had like kind of nerdy friends and I was very involved in like extracurricular activities. And then one summer we went to a race summit. We were talking a lot about like racism, and then we decided that we wanted to bring something like that to our school. We started this program called Racial Harmony. We had all of these workshops and we had all of these different racial and ethnic groups. There were conversations that we would have in our own racial groups and then conversations that we would have in the whole group. It was really powerful. And Stephen Miller went to my high school. And he hated Racial Harmony. My husband laughs that my like little Racial Harmony program like pissed Stephen Miller off.
I did Google it, and it turns out that Stephen Miller really did hate Racial Harmony.
Allegra decided to go up north for college. She wanted to be a casting director and found work after graduation in LA.
Meanwhile, Allegra's sister was pregnant and was planning on giving birth at a birth center in Berkeley. Allegra decided to head back up north to help her sister out.
I learned so much about pregnancy from my sister. She would kind of give me like the greatest hits of like interesting things that she was learning about her pregnancy. And it was like blowing my mind. I was there for like a week and I woke up to like really, really loud music playing, and I exited the room and my sister's husband was like, hey, Christina's in labor. She called the midwife, said it's not time for her to go to the birth center yet. So she got in the hot tub, it like lifted her belly up so it felt better. It's like less pressure. And then she like starts to have the baby in the hot tub. Her husband calls 911. I like opened the door for the fire department and I like moved the coffee table so they could bring the gurney in. But then by the time we got to the backyard, the baby was already born. And I'll just like never forget my sister. She was like wearing a sports bra and that's it. And she was like kind of standing up in shock. And her husband was like behind her holding the baby like above the water in the hot tub. I could see the umbilical cord like going from my sister and like to my niece. So actually my niece's birth was my first birth I ever attended. She's 15 and a half now. I just like love my niece so much. She's like my first favorite baby. Being there at that like accidental unassisted home birth, it really clicked for me. I was like, well, if the mom's body knows what to do and the baby's body knows what to do, and if they can figure out how to work it out together, why does that need to happen with a doctor? And so that's what like really got me thinking about home birth and midwifery.
Something really clicked for Allegra in this experience, but at this point, Allegra wanted a job that would pay the bills and provide some stability, and she went the whole ad agency route. After doing that for a while, she realized it wasn't the right fit for her.
I also started having this like real nag to do birth work. I actually watched the movie The Business of Being Born with my husband when we were like dating. And he had no idea that I wanted to be a midwife. He was just like watching this movie. You know, you see like Ricky Lake like give birth in a bathtub, and he was like, oh no, Allegra wants to have a baby. And he was like all freaking out. And then I told him that like there's no way I wanted to have a baby with him. I actually wanted to be a midwife. He was shocked and relieved, because I think at that point he was probably like maybe 24 years old or something. I took a doula training in July and I quit my job in August. And I was like, I'm just going to see if I can make it work.
It was a big step for Allegra to get trained up as a doula. And then she had to take on the next steps of, you know, building it into a career, whether it was building up her experience in the field, building relationships and a clientele.
And it took me a really long time to get hired as a doula, but I was able to like make a little money like doing childcare for some midwives. I was volunteering at a birth center called The Sanctuary. And finally, I attended my first birth. It was so hard. It was probably one of the longest births I've ever been to still like to date. And I loved it. Once I had the experience, it became a lot easier for me to have more experiences. I think I had a confidence issue because I was so young. I was like 27 and I wasn't a mom, and I had like almost seen my niece born, but like not really. I wasn't sure that I had anything to offer yet. And so once I started doing it, I started feeling more confident. And then with the help of my grandmother, Mamo, she helped me with my deposit for midwifery school. So I was able to enroll in midwifery school and start on that path to becoming a midwife.
One thing that was really interesting is how Allegra's early education at Play Mountain Place actually ended up being an asset for birth work so many years later.
I really got very good at supporting people through heavy emotional things. And I think that the school I went to and the childhood I had, it really has set me up for handling intense experiences, or like being not comfortable, but stable in tough experiences like that. Now that's kind of how I practice a lot. It's a lot of feelings work, and it's a lot of trauma work, and it's a lot of helping people live happy lives in spite of what experiences they've had in the past or in their birth. Like sometimes it's a lot of like processing through that kind of stuff. There's like so much I love about birth work. In the beginning, I was just happy to be there. I was just in love with birth in general. I was 100% in it for the parents, right? I was like there to offer them education and resources and reassurance.
So Allegra had settled into her career as a birth worker. And then meanwhile, there were other changes that were happening in her own personal life.
I got married while in midwifery school. Maybe like 2 years after that, I wanted to be a mom, but I really didn't want to be a student midwife and pregnant. You know, it's unpaid work. It's like an unpaid apprenticeship. I actually found out that I was pregnant maybe like a week after I passed my licensing exam. So I kind of just did like a few births and I worked up until I was about 32 weeks pregnant.
We're at this point where Allegra is now past her due date. She's hit 41 weeks.
And she's starting to get worried that she's never going to have this baby.
I went into Kaiser that day and I thought that they were going to try to pressure me into an induction that day and they were going to be mean to me or say that I shouldn't try to have the baby at home. So I really had like my armor all the way up and I got there. And it was like the nicest nurse. And she was super supportive and really encouraging. And like she'd had a baby at home. She thought it was so great. And I was just like so relieved by that.
I mean, what are you supposed to do at that point when you're this close, but the baby hasn't come? You go to your niece's birthday party, of course.
That's right. You meet up with your family.
I was just there feeling kind of crampy, having contractions. Everybody was there. And, you know, they were like, when do you think the baby's going to come? And I was like, I have no idea. And I texted my midwife at 11 at night and I told her that I was having some contractions and we were going to try to get some sleep. And I pretty much like went in the bathroom and like tried to see if I could like check myself. And I like popped my cervix open. And then I was like pretty much immediately in active labor. I told my husband that like the look on his face was hilarious. So he was like, why did you do that? I was like, I don't know. We started talking to the midwives more and I wanted them to come because I was having a hard time coping with how intense it was. So if I actually started like fake moaning in the background so that like she would come over. So she said that she would come. She actually stopped to pick up Kim on the way. And I like was teasing them because I was like, I was having the baby and you made a pit stop. By the time they got to my house, the baby was coming out. And I was like so out of it. I was like talking to the baby and I was saying like, slow down, baby, slow down. In my like crazy hormone flooded brain, I thought that I was having a uterine prolapse. Like it didn't occur to me that the baby was being born. I put my hand there and I tried to like hold it in. And right then is like when my midwives arrived.